The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Teen Vogue and The Teen Magazine. Today, we're going to start with two articles from Teen Vogue's The Uncounted series that elevates the stories of women of color who have been disenfranchised and often written out of history. The first article is titled The History of the Color White and Women's Suffrage Movement, How the Color Became a Symbol of Sisterhood and Solidarity by Laura Pitcher. This was published August 14th, 2020. Fashion has and always will be political. Throughout history, dress has always been used as a symbol of power, wealth, and status. Beyond that, the ways in which we dress can tie us to political and social movements, from the black berets worn by the Black Panthers to MAGA hats worn by Trump supporters today. This rings true for the women's suffrage movement, a decades-long fight for the right to vote for women in the United States. A lingering symbol of the movement is white clothing. Yet it was just one of the colors used by the suffrage movement. Following a 1908 rally in London's Hyde Park that attracted over 300,000 protesters wearing white, the visual impact of having a dress code became evident. Supporters had been encouraged to wear white dresses with tricolor sashes. Emmeline Pickett Lawrence, a suffragette and key member of the Women's Social and Political Union, which the Telegraph notes was the leading force behind the suffrage movement, is recognized as instituting three official colors in 1908, purple, white, and golden yellow. Case Western Reserve University history professor Inov Rabinovich Fox, Ph.D., told Teen Vogue that these colors were chosen to symbolize loyalty, purity, and hope. Purple is loyalty, loyalty to the cause. White is purity, and yellow is hope, she says. In the United States, white, purple, and gold were the official colors of the National Women's Party, according to the New York Times. They also were specifically selected as colors women might already have in their wardrobe, allowing more supporters to have access to the movement. With 20th century fashion also becoming more comfortable, the movement incorporated narrower skirts and less undergarments, said Rabinovich Fox. Rabinovich Fox explains that the women leading the suffragist movement were very media savvy. Not only for their time, but I think even for our time, she says. Off the back of previous fashion choices associated with feminism ending in mockery, such as the bloomer, she says the movement realized that gaining the right to vote would require building a new, more appealing image of what it means to advocate for women's rights. Glenda Tennan, one of the organizers of the National American Women's Suffrage Association, said, "An idea that is driven home to the mind through the eye produces a more striking and lasting impression than any that goes through the ear." Part of the reason why the color white stuck as the core color associated with the movement is that the photographic evidence from that period is in black and white, said Rabinovich Fox. Even when they used yellow, which I think actually at the time, yellow might have been more popular than white as a suffrage color, at least in the United States, on a black and white photograph, it still looked as white, she says. They definitely used white. It was not that white was a marginal color, partly because white was more available than a yellow dress and it's a cheaper fabric. With white clothing readily available and often cheaper, the color became a useful way for recruiting, says Rabinovich Fox. Black suffragists used the color beyond the struggle for the vote, wearing all white during the 1917 silent parade to protest lynching and racial discrimination. African American or working class women used the color white not only to support the suffrage cause, but also to show their own respectability in the public sphere and say, "We're pure, we're moral and respectable women," Rabinowitz Fox says, which is something black women did not have in public discourse. It's important to note that some white women leaders of the suffrage movement worked alongside white supremacists. It was mainly white women who won the right to vote in 1919, with women of color forced to wait nearly 50 extra years after the passage of the 19th Amendment to gain voting access. Today, women continue to wear the color to pay tribute to the suffragists and show sisterhood and solidarity. The House Democratic Women's Working Group urged female lawmakers to wear white for Trump's speech last year to honor all those who came before us and send a message of solidarity that we are not going back on our hard-earned rights. Hillary Clinton wore a white pantsuit during her acceptance speech at the 2016 Democratic National Convention. Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman to be elected to Congress, wore all white on her first day. So too did Congresswoman Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez. "I wore white today in honor of the women who came before me and the women yet to come," she wrote on her Instagram account. Chosen for its visual impact and accessibility, the color white became a political tool of dress, not only for the women's suffrage movement, but for black suffragists, who were at the forefront of a movement to protest racial discrimination also. While the color used in a unifying manner is clearly powerful, Inav Rabinowitz Fox is sorry that purple and yellow have dropped out of the conversation when talking about suffrage colors. Regardless, she sees the use of the color by women in politics today as an important nod to the movement. "Fashion has power, and we can use it to our favor. So why not?" she says. These historic roots make wearing white an international choice for politicians and leaders alike today, and the color, hopefully with the inclusion of purple and yellow, will continue to be a symbol of solidarity and sisterhood. This symbol, however, mustn't be celebrated without the awareness that the work towards equal voting rights is not yet finished. With voting restrictions impacting transgender people's rights to vote, and felony disenfranchisement disproportionately affecting black people. Okay, and the next article in the Uncounted series is titled, "These Teens Are Leading the Fight to Lower the Voting Age," by Lauren Young, and this was published August 13th, 2020. Who counts as a voter? Answering that question has been a driving force for change throughout United States history. And in a few cities and towns, the rules have already evolved to allow 16 and 17-year-olds to participate in some races. In 2013, Tacoma Park, Maryland, became the first city in the United States to allow people age 16 and up to vote in municipal elections, with two other Maryland cities, Hyattville and Greenbelt, and the town of Riverdale Park, following in years since. In 2016, Berkeley, California voters overwhelmingly approved a measure that extended to 16-year-olds the right to vote in school board elections. The legal voting age of 18 for state and federal elections is still a relatively new development in American political history, and was a largely unpopular idea with the majority of Americans until the mid-1950s. It wasn't until 1971 that the passage of the 26th Amendment officially granted 18-year-olds the right to vote in federal elections, which was the culmination of a campaign that dated back to World War II, when President Franklin D. Roosevelt announced his support for lowering the draft age from 21 to 18. Today, teenagers are again on the front lines of a social change, leading movements like Black Lives Matter, March for Our Lives, and the Sunrise Movement, which have impacted the political attitudes of generations of young people and helped spur to action millions of their older counterparts. Teen girls, in particular, have helped champion these fights. A lot of credit goes to young people who have helped a lot of minds to the idea, who have helped open a lot of minds to the idea that young people have a stake in our democracy and are very eager to participate in it, and actually care about public policy, understand how it affects them, and want to have a voice influencing it, says Brandon Klugman, a campaign manager for Vote 16 USA, which is a national campaign organized by the civics education organization Generation Citizen. Obviously, youth-led political engagements existed long before this moment, but maybe it didn't get the attention it always deserved. During the 2008 midterm elections, during the 2018 midterm elections, young people ages 18 to 24 showed up to the polls in record numbers, helping to elect the most racially and ethnically diverse and the most female congressional class in history, according to the Pew Research Center. A report released in May from the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, known as CIRCLE, found that in those midterm elections, white, Black, and Latinx women between ages 18 and 24 registered and voted at higher rates than their male peers. And Black and Latinx women were the most likely among all groups to say they were motivated to get involved in politics or be active in a social movement, followed by white women. And it's women, particularly young women of color, who stand to have their voices most amplified by the movement to expand voting rights to 16 and 17-year-olds. Kei Kawashima Ginsburg, director of CIRCLE, agrees. Anytime a person sees injustice in the system or the community, those are the people that are going to be really most committed to voting. In particular, with cases of racism or community violence, young women, especially young women of color, have been the most passionate advocates of those issues. Young people, again, particularly young women, see themselves as civic actors, but social constructs have limited the ideas about how much civic responsibility teenagers should take on. I think we do have a blind spot on what young people are capable of, Kawashima Ginsburg tells Teen Vogue. Last year, a poll commissioned by The Hill and Harris X found that 84% of registered voters opposed granting 16-year-olds the right to vote, while 75% opposed granting suffrage to 17-year-olds. Yet, research indicates that 16-year-olds are just as capable of voting as adults. A 2011 study published in the Annals of American Academy of Political and Social Science found that 16-year-olds demonstrated understanding similar to that of adults between the ages of 19 and 30 on measures of civic knowledge, political skills, and political efficacy, but scored markedly higher than 14-year-olds, suggesting significant developments in young people's understanding of these concepts before age 16, but little after. In March 2019, 126 members of the House of Representatives voted in favor of lowering the federal voting age from 18 to 16 after the bill was introduced on the House floor by Representative Ayanna Pressley. The bill failed to pass, but it spoke to the movement's growing strength. This November, San Francisco could become the first major U.S. city to extend the right to vote to 16 and 17-year-olds when voters decide on a charter amendment to allow people 16 and up to vote in municipal elections. It's an initiative that comes a long way in recent years, according to Ariana Nasiri, age 17 and a member of the San Francisco Youth Commission, who worked on this proposal and another that went before the city's voters in 2016, but fell short by just 4% of the vote. Ariana has pushed to shift the language of this latest effort to be less of a campaign to lower the voting age, but more of a campaign to expand democratic rights. Like most movements that try to expand suffrage, it's bringing as many voices of people who can speak to their lived experiences as possible, says Tyler Okiki, age 18. Now a student at the University of Chicago, Tyler served as a student representative on the Los Angeles Unified School District Board during his senior year of high school, when he authored a resolution directing the superintendent to report on the feasibility of a ballot measure to allow Los Angeles 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in school board elections. That expansion is similar to the long process of incremental change that has historically led to other major legislative and cultural changes in the United States, including universal women's suffrage and marriage equality. We felt that it was a step to extend democracy for everyone, and we felt that this was a first step because we are students, and school impacts us the most because we're there every day. This was from Malia Liao, who told Teen Vogue this. Malia, age 17, a high school student and organizer with Oakland Kids First, was part of the Bay Area City's recent successful effort to put a charter amendment on the November ballot that, if passed, will enable 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in school board elections. Oakland City Council members agreed unanimously to put the idea before voters in November. Research has shown that voting is habit-forming, and it increases a voter's likelihood to participate in future elections, which underscores the importance of having as stable an environment as possible for the youngest voters. But both Kawashima Ginsburg and Klugman point to the transitions that often accompany turning 18, such as graduating from high school, reaching the age of majority, starting college, and possibly living away from home for the first time, as factors that can actually make it more difficult for young people to vote. Everyone would have the opportunity to participate in one election before they reach the time of intense transition at age 18, says Klugman. He pointed out that a number of states currently allow 16-year-olds to pre-register to vote, which could further ease the process of registering new voters. Moreover, expanding the vote to 16 and 17-year-olds equips teenagers with a firmer network of resources and support, especially for those who may be the first in their family to vote or are from households where voting is not a regular occurrence. Young people need somewhere they can go to ask really basic questions. There's no better place than high school to be able to do that within a very educational context, says Kawashima Ginsburg. It's like driver's ed. This is very basic. Everybody should know that. And here are some of the pitfalls that young people sometimes miss. Everybody is put on the same starting line as a voter. Modeling habitual voting is particularly important for young girls to see and engage in as early as possible. Girls get subtle and sometimes not so subtle messages from our society that they don't know enough or don't have enough right to have a strong opinion or should just accept things as they are. Laura Kaufman, director of public policy at Girls Inc., tells Teen Vogue, "We want to make sure girls aren't intimidated from exercising their right. And the best way to do that is from a young age to make sure they see themselves as voters, potential leaders, and as civically engaged members of their communities." Other activists like Ella Yitzhaki from San Francisco are taking a different route to engage and expand the youth vote. In June, Ella, age 18, testified in front of the California Assembly Committee in support of Assembly Constitutional Amendment ACA 4. Which would have California join a number of states and the District of Columbia that allow 17-year-olds who will be 18 on election day to vote in congressional elections, primary elections, or caucuses. Her cause is about extending the voting age to people who are already voting in the general election, Ella says. It's not only has legal and constitutional standing, she points out, but based on all the encouragement that we've seen from folks who approve of the legislation, They realize that it's a rational and reasonable way to engage young people and give them the fair vote and the full vote. In February, a press release from Colorado's Secretary of State reported that 45.24% of eligible 17-year-olds turned out to vote in Colorado's presidential primary after the state passed a similar law last year, nearly matching the overall voter turnout in the state and surpassing that among those ages 18 to 34 by 15%. This is according to data from Vote 16 USA. Younger voters tend to be more liberal, but activists point out that their efforts have nothing to do with bringing in voters who are specifically blue, even if liberal states like California are currently seeing the most momentum build behind the issue. The intention is to expand voter rights to more accurately reflect the needs of the populace, Ariana says of her work in San Francisco, adding that she is a registered independent. If that happened to be a more progressive populace, so be it. If it happened to be a more conservative, so be it. We are not trying to prevent either or. Ella stresses a similar point. We're just trying to make sure that we create a stable and sustainable democracy. All right, and so our last article for today is going to focus on wellness. This is an article from the Teen Magazine titled, I Kept a Regular Sleep Schedule for a Month and Here's What Happened. This is by Clara Kemptov. Most teenagers have a really unusual sleep schedule right now, myself included. I almost never have planned activities in the morning anymore, so I don't always see the use of waking up early. I've never been a night owl, but I've been going to sleep as late as 3 a.m. and waking up past 11 a.m. I'm also told that I need to sleep more, but it's difficult to change my patterns when my body is so used to something different. On June 14th, I decided it was time to give it a try. I wanted to see how my life would change if I developed consistent and healthy sleep habits. My intentions were going to sleep before midnight, waking up at 8 a.m., turning off electronics and screens for 1 hour before going to sleep, eliminating any source of light before going to sleep, keeping a consistent evening routine consisting of brushing my teeth, getting changed, feeding my fish, journaling in bed, reading in bed until sleep. Week 1. I have to be honest, the first week was tougher than I expected. I found that I would start to feel tired at about 9 p.m., which is normal for me. I would stay awake a few more hours talking to friends or watching a movie, but come 11 p.m., I couldn't sleep. It was very irritating. I thought that my evening routine would bring me to the pleasant drowsiness that precedes a peaceful sleep, but I was mistaken. Even though I felt completely relaxed, I just couldn't fall asleep for at least an hour. I felt stuck in one of those when you can't fall asleep memes. One aspect that was fairly easy was waking up. No matter what time I drifted off, I had no problem with my 8 a.m. alarm. I found that I didn't necessarily feel well rested, but I've always been able to wake up at any time. My issue with those first few mornings was finding the motivation to get out of bed, since I didn't usually have plans. I had to fill up my few extra hours with pastimes, which were usually reading, making music, working on video projects, and one unfortunate off day, sharpening every pencil in the house. Reality time. I had one late night for a birthday party. I went to sleep at 4 a.m. and got up at 11 a.m. After 6 days of early bedtime, I was exhausted by midnight. That was my first indicator that my body may have been getting used to the new schedule. The next morning, I was exhausted. Not only did I naturally wake up at 9 a.m., I wasn't able to go back to sleep, regardless of how tired I was. It seemed like my body wanted to get started early, and I had no say in the matter. I stayed in bed for 2 more hours, but only managed to find that unsatisfying half-sleep that left me feeling even less rested. I was worried about disrupting the fragile internal clock I had started to set, but was curious to see how the evening would affect the weeks to come. Week 2. Week 2 started off similarly to the previous week, but I knew I had to make changes. I wasn't waking up feeling as rested as I would have liked, So I decided to set an earlier bedtime. I started going to sleep by 11 p.m., and what a difference it made. When I felt tired, instead of trying to stay up, I just went to bed. That simple. Even more satisfying was the fact that I was falling asleep faster than ever. Week 3. Week 3 was a little special. We were hit with a heat wave. With no air conditioning, sleep was tough. On particularly stifling evenings, I relocated to a couch in the basement, which was significantly cooler than my room. This was a quick fix, but it presented new challenges. My evening routine was thrown off. Due to the lack of sufficient lighting, I was unable to journal and read in the basement. By this time, though, I was used to going to sleep early. I felt comfortable getting ready in my room and then traipsing down the stairs to tuck myself in. Week 4. The last week. The home stretch. By this point, I was used to my schedule and it felt more normal. I knew I could finish off the month, but my dedication started to slip. Here's what happened. I was still feeling the same fatigue at night, but I was really missing those late-night conversations. In the last few days of the week, I gave up on turning off my phone, texted friends, called family, watched funny cat videos, everything. I was disappointed in myself, especially when I realized that I was taking longer to fall asleep afterward. Go figure. Maybe all the studies about cell phone use in beds are actually onto something. Positive results. Overall, I'd say this was a positive experience. I enjoyed the feeling of waking up well-rested, minutes before my alarm, and ready to start the day. It gave me a sense of purpose and direction, something I was lacking in the strange COVID world. As the month progressed, I also had more energy in the afternoon when I would usually have felt fatigued. As I mentioned above, it was highly gratifying to be able to exercise later in the day without feeling drained. Negative results. Throughout this process, I felt less connected to my friends and family. I wasn't able to talk to them late at night as I used to, so I found the first 2 weeks slightly isolating. As I progressed, it became more common for me to have those conversations early in the evening. Will I continue? Yes and no. Yes, I will continue to honor my tiredness when it hits. Yes, I will do my best to improve my quality of sleep. Yes, I will limit my screen time before getting into bed. Yes, I will try to talk to my loved ones at reasonable hours. Yes, I will do what I can as often as I can, but that's all. I no longer want to tie myself to a strict routine. I will maintain the same approximate schedule, but allow myself to listen to my body. If I need to sleep a few more hours on an off day, so be it. If I'm exhausted at 9 p.m., maybe I should turn in early. I believe that everyone can find comfortable and consistent sleep habits and reap the same benefits as me. I would recommend experimenting as I did, but perhaps with more realistic intentions. Personally, I would never have tried it without setting very specific guidelines. It was a great way to start, but I don't think it's the most sustainable way to proceed in the future. However you choose to try it, do your best, honor yourself along the way, and watch your life change. All right, we've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Teen Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919